Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Happy 5th of July. As I said before the news, Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, is our first guest today. Now 88 years old, but still visiting and writing about the country many consider the scene of his greatest foreign policy success, China, where he was known for thawing relations, the famous Nixon in China moment and all that flowed from that. Henry Kissinger has a new book called On China. We will talk to him about that and more. Dr. Kissinger, thank you for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Pleasure to be on.
First, to look back to the opening of China in 1972, was the reason, as many people say, to isolate and weaken the Soviet Union? And with 40 years of hindsight, how well did it work?
Well, there was a combination of reasons at the time. The United States was engaged in a war in Vietnam, which on China's border. There were profound debates in America about the commitment of any American administration to the cause of peace. And then there was the perennial Cold War that had been going on ever since the end of World War II. All of these were elements in the decision. On your specific question, did it isolate the Soviet Union? It substantially succeeded in isolating the Soviet Union.
In what ways that were seeable at the time? That changed their behavior or strengthened the U.S.? What's the most concrete evidence looking back?
Well, first of all, you ought to understand the following. You're looking at something 40 years ago, and you're judging it by current standards, and you expect that some dramatic result occur immediately. That's not the way foreign policy works. But in this particular case, it was there were immediate indications before the opening to China. The Berlin negotiations, the negotiation about access to Berlin, had been dragging along. The Soviet Union was making all sorts of conditions about negotiating with the United States about a whole series of issues. And within about 6 weeks of the first trip to China, the Soviet Union demeanor towards the United States changed totally, partly because they wanted now to isolate China and try to get into a position in which they had better access in Washington. And that put us into the situation where we could conduct foreign policy with the two superpowers, two communist superpowers, mm-hmm. in such a way that we were closer to each of them than they were to each other, and so could balance that relationship, and so that the Soviet Union could never conduct a pressure on Europe without having to think about its rear.
Closer to each of them than they were to each other. That's really interesting. To stay with that era for a moment, some conservatives see you as too soft on the evil empire of Russia plus communist China when you should have been saying things like tear down that wall instead of looking to make detente, which accepted their existence.
Yeah,
on China, people say you kind of legitimized the regime that Mao had set up after he killed tens of millions of Chinese. What do you say to those critics today?
Well, first of all, they weren't saying it in 1971. They're saying it now with 40 years in retrospect. And the general criticism made of the Nixon administration was that their foreign policy was too tough, not that it was too soft. Secondly, the foreign policy of the Nixon administration was systematically to undermine the satellite orbit. Nixon was the first president to visit Eastern Europe. Nixon announced a visit to Romania for a time that a Communist Party Congress had been scheduled, and they showed their preference for an American visit to a Brezhnev visit who was going to come to that Party Congress. Then we visited Poland, and we visited Yugoslavia, and so the settled policy of the Nixon administration was to systematically undermine the Soviet position in Eastern Europe. There was not one dramatic speech like saying tear down the wall, but there was no question that we were systematically seeking to weaken the Soviet position. Secondly, we started the European Security Conference, which was then completed in the Ford administration, which laid the basis for the solidarity movement and which enshrined human rights in an international agreement. Now, as far as Mao is as far as China is concerned, the opening to China did not legitimize Mao. Mao was in office. The common consensus at the period was followed by every other democratic government and preceded by other democratic governments, that China needed to be brought into the international system if one was going to have progress towards peace. And the idea that we should have added a confrontation with China to a crisis in Vietnam is something that's easy to do in 2011. It was not a thoughtful policy then.
Dr. Henry Kissinger, my guest on WNYC, his new book is called On China and to the Present. Do you think Americans should fear China? Would that be the appropriate dominant emotion?
I think China is developing economically in an extraordinary way. China also has enormous domestic problems. We should certainly understand that China has the potential to aspire to the dominance of Asia. We also should attempt to bring about a situation in which this does not lead to another series of conflicts. But we should surely be aware of the potential of China and understand that we are in a competitive situation.
How much power do you think China has over the U.S. today? Because it owns so much of our debt. That is something, as you know, that's constantly in the popular discourse.
You know, this is one of these strange situations. We owe them a lot of money. But on the other hand, it's commonly thought that the debtor has a strong hand when he owes a lot of money. Because if the Chinese were to attempt to exploit that creditor position, they would lose the export markets from which the creditor position arose. So it is not a good position to be in, not so much because of what China can do to us, but because of what it tells us about a competitive situation and of a one-sided trade relationship, and that should not be continued.
Although, did I understand correctly in your book that you said China will kind of be drafted into the leadership role in the world because of ongoing paralysis in the United States, but also because China is now in the position that the United States was in after World War II, which is the biggest creditor nation in the world?
No, I didn't say that in the book. I said that in a speech in China a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing like that in the book.
Okay. So on that thought,
but it's a correct description of my view. My view is that the United States, that in that speech in China, I pointed out that until the end of World War II, Britain was the principal creditor in the world and therefore ran the reserve currency. Then it moved to the United States, and now China is in the position. And the position arises from the fact that when you're owed a lot of money, you have to, it's in your interest to create conditions in which it can be repaid, so that the creditor nation has to wind up in time as working for a constructive international system.
And what about that ongoing paralysis in the United States? And you also said in Europe...
I didn't say, incidentally, ongoing paralysis in the United States in that speech.
Okay.
I spoke entirely of the role of China.
It is, well, maybe it was summarized that way. I've been reading a lot about your recent work as well as reading the book.
No, you got it correctly. You quoted me correctly. It just wasn't in the book.
Is the do you see our government as being in paralysis, and is it because of partisan polarization about the size of government?
I would say our system is sort of in a kind of paralysis, yes.
Over partisan polarization on the size of government?
It's reflected in partisan polarization, not just about the size of government, but about a whole range of issues. Size of government, extent of spending, nature of the tax system. They're all seemingly deadlocked.
Do you have any suggestion for a way out? I mean, a big picture way out, so that the United States can continue to grow and challenge China in ways that we need to challenge China?
Well, you know, I basically believe that societies grow and become great not by their conflicts, but by their reconciliations. And I'm hoping that at some point the leadership of both parties will agree not just on what concessions they need to make, but what picture of America they want to support, whether that takes another presidential election or two. But at the end of the day, that's what America needs to come to.
In your opinion, is our middle class doomed to shrink by dint of globalized competition, largely from China pushing down wages, or from concentration of wealth in fewer hands domestically in this country, some combination of those things? Is our middle class doomed to shrink?
I think our middle class is under pressure. I hope it is not doomed to shrink, because it's a satisfied middle class which creates the motor for a growing and self-confident society. Secondly, we shouldn't blame everything on China. I say that not because I have a disproportionate affection for China, but because we have to learn which problems are caused by us and which problems are caused by others. And if we blame everything on others, then we think we can just sit back and let some sort of conflict take care of it. I think China is a problem, but it isn't China alone. It is the rise of countries like India, Brazil, China. It's that the underdeveloped countries are beginning to represent the greater market in the world, and its stabler economic conditions. And that is a fundamental change of what the world looked like at the end of World War II and right into the up to the end of the 20th century.
Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times columnist, wrote a few years ago that it's not so much communist China anymore as, and he used this term, fascist China, because they have an authoritarian government in back of a capitalist economy. What do you think of that characterization?
Well, I wouldn't call them a fascist government, because the fascist government really depended on the rule of one man. Now it's sort of a a composite leadership, but it's a different. It's a government more as a style like the Mexican government used to be before the multi-party system emerged there about 10 years ago.
Do we need some protectionist policies? I know that's a dirty word, in the United States to defend against China as well as some of the other developing countries you mentioned, just taking more and more manufacturing and other jobs at lower and lower wages?
I don't think actually that the challenge of China is lower and lower wages, because almost every economist agrees that the wages in China are rising, as one expects in any industrializing country. The challenge, economic challenge of China, it's not going to be in the next decades in the low-wage industries. It's in the high-tech or medium-tech.
But wouldn't they still be very low wages compared to what most Americans would expect for the same work?
They are higher than they are in other developing countries. My point is, your question shouldn't be directed at one country, but at the whole structure of the globalized world.
And my question is still, maybe you don't want to answer on the level of economics, is can we easily dismiss some kind of protectionism to protect as large as possible the middle class in the United States for the foreseeable future anyway?
Well, I have never pretended to be an economist. The conventional wisdom on this is that globalization benefits everybody. But let me turn it around in another way. I believe that a certain reindustrialization of America is necessary, and that the decline of our industrial base is one of the causes of having the possibility of a recovery, of a jobless recovery.
How do we do that if manufacturers find it in their interest to outsource to China and India, et cetera?
Yeah, but Germany has managed to do it. They have high wage rates.
How?
As I told you, I am not an expert on this. But Germany has done it by great emphasis on research and by apparent pacts between employers and unions, which have enabled them to maintain an industrial base and a significant export market.
Henry Kissinger is my guest on WNYC. His new book is called On China. We'll continue after a break. And when we do, Dr. Kissinger, I want to ask you about some of the things you wrote in the book about sort of the creation myth, or almost lack of creation myth, of the nation of China and how that relates to their current politics. I'll also be curious to hear how you compare the diplomatic approaches toward China of the last two administrations. So stay with us, please. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, whose new book is called On China. Of course, one of the things most associated with Henry Kissinger historically was his opening to China in the Nixon administration. And Dr. Kissinger, the book opens with the chapter, The Singularity of China. And you write, a special feature of Chinese civilization is that it seems to have no beginning. It appears in history less as a conventional nation-state than a permanent natural phenomenon. Is that just sort of anthropologically interesting, or is that important in some way that relates to relations with China today?
Well, it is both, because unlike much of the history of most countries, there's no George Washington in China, or a Romulus, as there was in in Roman history. And secondly, because it extends over such a long period of time, 4,000 years of uninterrupted government, 2,000 years of the modern kind of government, so that the perspective of the Chinese is different when they look at foreign policy. And also that history is sort of a living thing for them in a way that it is in view. In fact, I know no other society. For example, when Mao decided to move towards the United States, he asked four marshals to write an analysis of the international situation. And they came to the conclusion that it was necessary to move towards the United States. And they said, how are we going to explain this to Mao? One of them said, say it's like the Hitler-Stalin pact. Another one said, no, that's not the way to do it. Tell him it's like a chapter of a 600-year-old novel that describes a Chinese war of 1,000 years before that. And they said, A, he will have read that novel. Secondly, he'll understand that. And so what the Chinese tend to do is when situations arise, they do it more with historical analogies. No American president would refer to what happened under President Polk in the middle of the 19th century.
Right.
Chinese would do that quite frequently.
Could I ask you to compare the diplomatic styles toward China of our last two secretaries of state, Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice? How are they different, and do you think either has been more effective?
You know, the interesting thing about Chinese policy is that I would say the most consistent policy we have had in American diplomacy is the China policy. Eight American presidents, starting with Nixon, have more or less conducted a comparable policy. And I would feel that, of course, Condi and Hillary are two different people. Condi Rice is more professorial and academic. Hillary is more operational. But in terms of the basic direction, I think they're very similar.
What do you think should be the proper proper place of human rights in U.S.-China policy? This continues to be extremely contentious.
Well, there are two aspects to it. One, the United States is based on its convictions on human rights. It can never abandon affirming the importance of these principles. Secondly, in the modern world, these principles cannot be contained by national borders, and so it is inevitable that when issues involving human rights occur, that the United States will express its views. The debate occurs on whether sanctions and pressures should be used on top of the expression of preferences, and this is where people debate.
And your view?
My view is that, as a general rule, it is better to try to do it by engagement, that is, by pressures that are not creating situations where a public yielding is necessary, but where a gradual transformation can take place. But I apply that primarily to diplomats. I do not object to private groups expressing their preferences as strongly as they feel they need to.
This also harkens back, I think, to your time in office under Nixon and Ford. We talked earlier about some of the reasons you were controversial on the right. People on the left saw you as Christopher Hitchens would put it, a war criminal, and we won't rehash all of that, for having the U.S. support all kinds of dictators as long as they were on our side against the Soviets. But do you have any regrets along those lines from a human rights perspective?
Well, first of all, You know, it's easy to make these statements. What do people mean by supporting dictators? And what exactly did we do that, in quotation mark, supported which dictator against whom? And what were our options? In what people often mention, it's the example of the Shah of Iran. And if you look at what happened after the Shah was overthrown in terms of the position of America in the Middle East, of the human rights conditions within Iran, that was, one can understand what the real choices were, and what the support consisted of was to say, we have plenty of enemies already. Let's not add that one to it.
And people will say East Timor, Chile, Vietnam itself, South Vietnam, and we don't need to go over that. But
the mere fact that they say it doesn't make it true. We inherited the war in Vietnam. When we came into office, there were 550,000 Americans in place in Vietnam, and you can't treat that as if it were a television series that you can simply turn off. And the Chile issue is also almost always totally misrepresented.
But here's the question I do want to ask relevant to that era, because it's relevant to today. Did realpolitik, if that's the right word, not contribute to the conditions, and this is not just about you, but about, you know, many American administrations, did it contribute to the conditions that led to 9/11, because we propped up the Saudi and Egyptian and other repressive Arab governments whose rule was not at all consistent with American values for the sake of oil or strategic advantage? I think President Bush ultimately came to the conclusion and said publicly that strategy backfired.
Well, first of all, some of this can be ascribed to any lack of historical sense. When you say propped up, there was a war going on in Vietnam. There was a Cold War going on with the Soviet Union. There were crises all over the world, and it was a natural attitude of a whole series of American administrations that you do not start additional crisis. Secondly, let's look at what the evolution is first of the kinds of revolutions that are now taking place before you generalize too much about propping up which government. And when you hear that phrase, I'm saying to your listeners, ask yourself, what did the propping up consist of? Of course, there are many situations in which you would like to prefer a Jeffersonian government that does not make any military or economic demands on you. But the essence of policymaking is that there are only so many issues you can deal with at a time. And now let me make one final point. Mm-hmm. We have run a little longer than we had planned. Let me make one point. The phrase realpolitik. I have never used it. This is what my critics like to use, because they give it a German word, and then they say, if it's a German word, it's got to be terrible. Let me state what my view is precisely, then you can give it any label you want to. Mm-hmm. My view is, as a student of history, as someone who lived in a dictatorship and therefore has no desire to see any dictatorship anywhere, and lived in a dictatorship as a persecuted minority. But my study of history tells me this. You cannot have peace in the world without a certain equilibrium of power. Because if you don't have equilibrium, then the ruthless and powerful can do what they want. But secondly, you cannot have equilibrium unless most people feel that the arrangements are just, because otherwise they have no interest in sustaining it. So the real art of foreign policy, and what I have tried to write about, It's to find the balance between equilibrium and justice and legitimacy. Now, this is a very delicate and difficult task, and I've written a lot about it. But you shouldn't think that I believe all you have to do is flail about yourself with your fists, and that power is the only determinant. Power has a role, and a sense of justice has a role. And when you go too much in the direction of power, you get into constant conflict. But when you go too much in the ideological direction, you get crusades. And a lot of people have been killed by crusades. But when you try to strike that balance, you can get attacked from the left and the right. And I may tell you, in that sense, I have unified.
You certainly have. May I ask you for 2 more minutes of your time to ask you a question about your childhood?
Yes.
Because as it happens, we have a special guest in the control room today watching the show, a World War II veteran named Dr. Harold Blogg, an Army Air Force pilot who did time as a POW after he was shot down in Germany with my father-in-law, who was his navigator. You were a refugee from the Nazis. You served in the U.S. military in hazardous intelligence duty during World War II. People rarely talk about that part of your life.
Well, before that, in hazardous infantry duty, and then in hazardous intelligence duty.
Yes. And since you came of age at that time, can you put into words what, if anything, the horror of Nazism did to shape your worldview or your desire to work in foreign policy?
Look, Hitler came to power when I was barely 9 years old. And from that point on, the Jewish community in Germany was segregated and came under increasing pressure, excluded from public places. And then in time, under physical attack, and as kids you were immediately under physical attack, because every Hitler Youth boy could beat you up in the street. So that was the reality that I saw, and I saw a world disintegrate. So I have tried to devote my life to promoting peace as I understood it, as I've just explained it to you, and also to try to heal divisions in this country. And one reason some on the left and some on the right are attacking me, because they think I ought to belong to them. And I try to take a position that stands above these disputes. But that is my own interpretation, of course.
By the way, Dr. Blogg just whispered in my ear that you and he both went to George Washington High School, and you're about the same age, but he didn't know you.
Yeah, we both went to George Washington High School, and I don't know when he went there. I went in the late 30s.
Yes. His wife is nodding right around then. Anyway, Henry Kissinger, his new book is called On China. I appreciate all the time you gave us today.
And I appreciate the way you questioned this.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how IBM helped shape America.